And so what I thought I would do before I get started with my presentation is just share a little bit about my own background and entry into conservation to give you a little bit more of a perspective on me. So I did not grow up in the West. In fact, I grew up in New Jersey. And when you grow up in New Jersey, there's never a reason to leave. And I didn't until I went to college. I had never been outside of New Jersey. In fact, what I was going to say until I told my wife this was I had never been west of New Jersey until I went to Ireland. And Betsy informed me that Ireland's actually east of New Jersey. But it wasn't until I went to college and discovered fly fishing and fell in love with fly fishing that I had actually left the state. And then I returned back to New Jersey after graduation and put my liberal arts degree to good use by working in an ice cream factory and coaching high school football. And my buddy Mickey was similarly putting his liberal arts degree by bartending in Homer, Alaska. And Mick encouraged me to come out and visit him and see Alaska and maybe even do some salmon fishing. And I had heard about salmon, but I didn't really know much about them. And so I went out to Alaska. I brought my fishing gear with me, and Mick allowed me to use his old VW Rabbit to drive from Homer down to the Kenai Peninsula to fish the Anchor River. And I ended up getting to the anchor at about 5-6 o'clock. I set up camp on the beach, parked the car next to the tent, and made dinner and went to bed. And woke up at about 3 a.m. with the tide rolling in my tent. In New Jersey, we have 18-inch tides. In Alaska, they have 10-foot tides. And the real problem was that the VW Rabbit was parked in front of the tent. So needless to say, I didn't get out early the next day. It took me a while to get the car pulled out and several cans of gum out to get it started again, but I did. And I began walking up the Anchor River, and as I rounded a bend, I began to notice these giant, dead and dying fish with these big hooked jaws and these big hump backs, and they were sloughing flesh. And I distinctly remember to this day taking the tip of my fly rod and poking one of these zombie fish and seeing it, sort of much to my horror, sort of like sidle out into the stream and just sort of float down river half dead. And I thought, and this is the God's honest truth, I thought, this is unbelievable. I finally get a chance to go west, to Alaska. And somewhere upriver, a train fell off the trestle and dumped a bunch of acid in the river and has killed all these fish. So what I didn't realize at the time was that these were, of course, king salmon or Chinook salmon. I was there to fish for silvers, and they had already spawned out. And I walked a little further upriver, paying special care not to allow any of that toxic material in the river to get on my waders. I had a sweet pair of, remember these, the Ranger waders, the Uniwader, the rubber ones? I had just bought a pair for this trip. And I saw this fool standing in the middle of the river fishing. And I stopped to watch him for a while, and as often happens when two people are alone and one person is staring at the other, this guy looks over at me and he says, "What?" And I looked at him and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, I'm fishing. I said, "Aren't you worried about whatever killed all these fish getting on your waders?" And he looked at me and he said, "Dude, those are salmon. I mean, that's part of what happens." And I nodded my head, and I never stepped foot in the river that day. I turned back. I walked to the car. I got the waders off, and I drove to the Anchorage Public Library, and I got a book out on salmon that I read by campfire that night. And I learned that these magnificent creatures can travel 1,000 miles in places like the Yukon, and they undergo this remarkable transformation as they migrate up the river. They drop their scales. They begin feeding off the fat that they've consumed in the ocean. And they go through this extraordinary physical transformation that physically alters the shape of their bodies until they return to their natal stream, the place that they were born. And they spawn one time, and then they die. And then their bodies provide the nutrients that allow their progeny to thrive and eventually, complete the cycle. And I thought, man, that is really cool. That's what I want to do. I want to work with salmon. So I not knowing that you didn't need to write a letter of resignation from an ice cream factory. I wrote a letter of resignation from the ice cream factory that night. And I went back home to New Jersey. And after the vacation was over, and I was in my parents' kitchen on Monday morning, and my father came downstairs. And my father said what every father should say to a child when they are in their home after graduating on a Monday morning. What the hell are you doing here? And I said, Dad, I quit my job. And he looked at me and he said, well, what are you going to do? And and that morning, this is the truth. That morning in the New York Times, there was a picture of a guy kneeling next to a lake, and his name was Keith Edwards. And the caption under the photograph said, it saddens me that I work at a lake that's named for a fish that doesn't return anymore. And that was the year that one sockeye salmon made that 768-mile journey, you know, gaining 7,800 feet in elevation to get back to Redfish Lake, only to find that no other sockeye had returned to spawn with. It was the sockeye that the WAGs called Lonesome Larry. And I pointed to that photograph, and I said to my dad, I'm going to save the salmon, Dad. And my father, who's a very colorful man from Newark, New Jersey, responded, but I'm not going to actually tell you what he said. So anyway, I ended up following through on that. We finished out the football season, but then I went to Idaho. I volunteered for the Forest Service and then got on as a seasonal employee. And we were doing these paired watershed studies. So we would look at a watershed that had been heavily damaged, heavily eroded, heavily mined in the past, and one that was relatively pristine. And we were, you know, just comparing how those systems worked and didn't work and how quickly sediment was flushing out of the impaired watershed, et cetera. And we were working on the South Fork of the Salmon River drainage. This is a drainage that historically 50% of all of the steelhead in the Columbia River Basin used to spawn in the Salmon River drainage. And we were at this place called Poverty Flats. And it was a big, wide expanse, probably as wide as this auditorium. And we were there counting reds. Unfortunately, there were no reds there. But we were gathering up our equipment and getting ready to go back to our camp at the end of the day. And out in the middle of this big flat, this big Chinook salmon just leapt out of the water, straight up in the air, body completely out, and fell back to the water. You know, we all sort of did that double take and looked at one another like, did you see that? And that salmon did that same thing 5 times in a row. And every time that fish jumped, all of us in unison said, yeah! We all yelled, yeah! And it was as though its body were an exclamation point to the word live. So my story is not unique. I am fairly confident that those of you who are here for a reason. And you all probably have a very similar story that helps explain why you are so passionate about these fish and about protecting the places that these fish live. And so it's in the spirit of that story that I want to confess, Saving the World One Trout at a Time was a bit of a placeholder title for me. What I really wanted to call this talk was What New Jersey Can Teach Montana. But my colleagues in the office suggested that wouldn't go over well. So I think a more accurate title for this talk would be How Montana is Saving the Rest of the Country One Trout at a Time. 3 issues demonstrate Montana's status as a national leader in conservation and a pathfinder for helping us, the rest of us, to take better care of the lands and waters that sustain us all. First is the legacy of wild fish management in the state. Second, the practice of something that we call collaborative stewardship. And third is the transformation in Montana's water law and policy. And I want to speak about each of those 3 areas briefly. The idea that quality habitat is key to great fisheries was a founding principle of Trout Unlimited. So TU was founded 55 years ago, on the banks of the Asable River in Michigan, by a group of anglers who had grown frustrated by the fact that the state was masking habitat degradation by pumping out ever more cookie-cutter hatchery trout into the rivers and streams of Montana, in this case, the Asable. And it was a very typical response to natural resource degradation. We try to apply a technological fix to a natural resource problem. And when I was thinking about my remarks this morning, it reminded me of an essay by Wendell Berry, called Solving for Pattern in a wonderful book called The Gift of Good Land. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it to you. I just want to share this quote with you. Berry writes, "Another kind of solution is that which immediately worsens the problem it is intended to solve, causing a hellish symbiosis in which problem and solution reciprocally enlarge one another in a sequence that, so far as its own logic is concerned, is limitless. As when the problem of soil compaction is solved by a bigger tractor, which further compacts the soil, which makes a need for a still bigger tractor, and so on and on. There is an identical symbiosis between coal-fired power plants and air conditioners. It is characteristic of such solutions that no one prospers by them but the suppliers of fuel and equipment. These two kinds of solutions are obviously bad. They always serve one good at the expense of another or of several others. The whole problem must be solved, not just some handily identifiable and simplifiable aspect of it. Bigger tractors do not solve the problem of soil compaction any more than air conditioners solve the problem of air pollution." So clearly, Berry was talking about agricultural practices, but it's very similar in fisheries management. The problem, historically, had been degraded habitat and declining fisheries. And so the solution, the technological fix, rather than go back and repair the habitat, fix the underlying problem, we were masking it with hatchery fish to keep anglers happy, a very likely source of complaint if the habitat wasn't repaired. Well, happily, Trout Unlimited was founded. And even more happily, 5 years later, 4 or 5 years later, a few conservation legends, at least one of whom is in the audience today, Bud Lilly, Dan Bailey, and Bud Morris, created the first Montana chapter of Trout Unlimited. The state of Montana was actually the first state to apply our motto, "Take care of the fish, and the fishing will take care of itself," as the basis for its entire approach to fisheries management. And I'm not suggesting that they did that because of us. But what's remarkable, and I'm going to tell that story in just a moment, is that this was done more than 40 years ago, and no other state in the country has even partially followed the lead of Montana. And it's a remarkable and signature achievement that you should all be extraordinarily proud of. So going way back to 1966, a man by the name of Dick Vincent, who was a young Montana State University fisheries biologist, was hired by the state to develop techniques to inventory large rivers. And in the context of doing his research, Dick noticed that where stocking was heavy, wild trout populations were depressed. And Dick's boss, Ron Marcot, and the state proposed a new approach to emphasizing wild fish management on the Madison and elsewhere. This was an incredibly controversial proposal. Business owners weren't happy. Trout anglers weren't happy. Some local thugs even tampered with the trailer that Dick was using, and it nearly led to a fatality when a woman driving a car was almost killed when the boat came free from the trailer. But to a few anglers and to this new organization, Trout Unlimited in Montana, they formed a core of advocates that helped convince the public and the Fish and Game Commission that stocking on top of wild trout populations was neither economical nor was it ecological. And that set in motion a broad policy change in the state and a moving away from emphasizing hatchery production to focusing on habitat quality. And today, Montana is the international destination. Hell, we're having Troutapalooza here. It's the international destination for trout fishing, and there is a reason for that, and you should be very proud of that reason. But wild fish still need people who will care for them, and that's where collaborative stewardship comes in. So collaborative stewardship is simply defined as it's a very simple idea that conservation, which is most local and involves the most people, is most durable. If you give wild and native fish half a chance, they will come back. Montana has demonstrated that. And that's why the Montana story of restoration is so hopeful for the rest of the country. And that's important to keep in mind, because one of the great dangers for those of us who work in the business of conservation is creeping cynicism or negativity. You can, in a very real sense, you can make an argument that what we do on a daily basis is oversee loss, right? Loss of water quality, loss of forest health, loss of air quality, loss of endangered species. It even affects some of our great leaders in the conservation movement, people like Aldo Leopold. In a wonderful essay that he wrote in 1948 called An Ecological Conscience, Leopold wrote that one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Much of the damage inflicted on the land is quite invisible to the layman, and an ecologist must either harden his shell and make believe that the consequences of science are none of his business, or he must be the doctor who sees the marks of death in a community that believes itself well and doesn't want to be told otherwise. But the fact is that conservation is the most forward-looking, affirmative idea that the United States ever gave the rest of the world. And collaborative stewardship is the on-the-ground manifestation of that sense of optimism and hope. And it yields results on the ground. So consider the case of the Blackfoot. Since I was at the library today, I will say that one of my favorite opening and closing lines in all of fishing literature is from Norman MacLean's wonderful book, A River Runs Through It. And of course, those lines are, in my family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. And the closing line is, I am haunted by waters. Well, in the span of time that Norman MacLean wrote that book about the Blackfoot, and Brad Pitt taught us how to shadow cast, and the movie was made, the Blackfoot had undergone a tremendous amount of degradation from historic mining practices, historic logging, and historic roading practices. It got to the point that native and wild fish were deeply, deeply imperiled. And what happened is the local community got together and created something called the Blackfoot Challenge. It was comprised of county commissioners, state and federal agencies, ranchers, and the local chapter there, the TU Big Blackfoot chapter. And they spent years working to help repair the Blackfoot system. Years and years working on riparian restoration and upland restoration, road obliteration, and the results have been nothing short of remarkable. In areas where they went and helped, and they recreated the riparian canopy, the streamside canopy, to help shade the stream and provide cover for fish, we've seen temperature decreases of 15 degrees, and trout need cold, clean water. It's gotten to the point now where West Slope cutthroat, the native trout there, are actually supplanting, they're pushing out the wild species, which is a good thing. And one of the most remarkable statistics from that project is that bull trout are a threatened species, have increased, and reds are the nests that trout make. I probably don't need to say that for you all. But bull trout reds have increased by 800% from pre-restoration levels in some areas. It's a remarkable success story. Collaborative stewardship allows you to tackle the big, hairy, thorny, red light issues that have historically lacked resolution. And the TU staff have heard me say many times that I often look at TU as the patron saint of forgotten environmental causes. And one of the signature of those are abandoned mines in the western United States. The West has a tremendous legacy of mining. We settled the West largely on the back of mining. But what we forgot to do was to create a mechanism to clean up in the aftermath of that mining. Historic mining practices were extremely harmful to the environment. And no one was acting out of malice. It was just what we knew at the time. We didn't know any better. But we live with that legacy today, and there is no one there to clean those mines up. And the effect is fairly profound. The EPA has estimated that 40% of all headwater streams in the West are negatively affected by abandoned mines. And these headwater streams are exactly where all of our native fish are holed up right now. It's imperative that we get those suckers cleaned up. And about 15 years ago, TU began a very ambitious project to clean up abandoned mines around the West. And we've been helped by a ton of partners in the state and federal agencies, mining companies in some cases, and even Curious partners, seemingly curious partners, such as Tiffany and Company, who have invested several million dollars in helping to clean up abandoned mines around the West. But one of my favorite stories is on a little tributary of Nine Mile Creek called Twin Creek, which is a tributary of the Clark Fork. And this is an area that 80 to 100 years ago, they basically had completely separated this creek from the main stem. They had just diverted it for purposes of mining, and it had never been put back. And so TU went up there with Missoula County and the Lolo National Forest and the state, and we recontoured about five. We found out where the historic channel was, which wasn't easy to do after 80 years, but we found out where the historic channel was. We recontoured it, put the sinuosity back into it, put the structure back in and the habitat that trout need to survive. And then they lifted, I assume it was some sort of coffer dam, but they opened the gate to let the water back into the historic channel. And you know what happened? The moment they opened the gate, trout started moving up the channel. They hadn't been there in 80 years. And the moment they opened the gate, trout began moving up the channel. If you give these fish half a chance, they will respond. A final thing that collaborative stewardship teaches us is that conservation isn't really about land, and it's not really about water, and this is a daring thing for me to say in this room. It's not really even about fish. It's about people, and it's about the relationship that people have with one another. And historically, conservation or environmental protection has been looked at as the zero-sum game of winners and losers. And consequently, we'll go through periods where we feel like we're winning, and then we'll go through other periods where we're losing. And collaborative stewardship is a bulwark against that kind of thinking. And a great example of that here in Montana was an initiative that my friend Senator John Tester started called the Forest Jobs Recreation Act. And there, Montana TU and Tom Reed, actually, of TU National, working with other partner organizations, began this dialogue with the timber industry in the state. And they reached an agreement where we were going to be able to protect for the first time, I think since before the Reagan administration, about 600,000 acres of protected lands, including a lot of wilderness, really important, the most important areas for fish. And the timber industry was going to be able to work in a predictable and stable way on a series of landscapes that needed hazardous fuels treatments. It was a total win-win solution. And unfortunately, the politics in Washington, D.C., wouldn't allow that bill to go anywhere, and it still hasn't, shamefully, to my way of thinking, gone anywhere. But even if that bill doesn't ever move, and I do hope it will, the fact is that those relationships that we developed with those folks from the forest products industry, they will last a long time. Those are friendships now that are built upon hours of meeting across tables and probably more than a few beers and probably more than a few meals at one another's homes. And those relationships will last and they will work for us in the future, even if we don't see the Forest Jobs Recreation Act made into legislation. So I want to talk a little bit about water policy now. It is a truism that wild and native fish need water every second of every day. And building flexibility into historically rigid state water laws is a great way to help fish contend with what will likely be a long period of prolonged drought in the West. Since the mid-1800s, like much of the West, Montana's water law was governed by something called the Prior Appropriations Doctrine. And essentially what this meant was if you were you held a senior water right and you didn't put that right to productive use on the landscape, meaning for agricultural purposes, you would lose that water, which is often the most valuable part of your property, you would lose that water to the next downstream junior water right holder. It was a profound disincentive for leaving water in stream for fish. Then in 1975, the state legislature passed the Montana Water Use Act, and it basically authorized the Fish and Game Department to petition for in-stream flow rights. Around that same time, Trout Unlimited chapters emerged in Bozeman and Butte and became very active in advocating for in-stream flow and doing things like habitat protection and restoration. And then in 1998, or around there, we had the good fortune to hire Stan Bradshaw and Laura Ziemer, two immense legal talents who created a broad space for fisheries in Montana's water law. And Pat Byorth continues that excellent work with them today. They helped to make permanent changes to the Montana Water Code such that Montana today has the most fish-friendly water laws in the entire western United States. There is an in-stream flow leasing program that has been made permanent and that we have used many, many times, which I will describe in just a moment. But think about that for a moment. Montana went, in the period of 20 or 30 years, from having some of the most rigid, inflexible water law in the West to today having the most progressive water law, progressive if you're a trout anyway, in the entire western United States. And today we have more than 24 water leases where we're basically keeping in-stream flow, we're restoring stream flow during dry summer months and fall months, including one on the Sun River. And this is a partnership I just want to talk briefly about, but it's a partnership between Trout Unlimited, the Bureau of Reclamation, Coca-Cola, which is always kind of catches my eye, and the Fort Shaw Irrigation District and the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. And early monitoring is suggesting that fish populations have tripled as a result of that water being left in stream. And I'm happy to tell you all that the Sun River Partnership was recently nominated for the North American River Prize, one of only 4 rivers in the country that were nominated. But it's an incredibly prestigious award given by the International River Foundation. In Montana, we are demonstrating the importance of connecting surface and groundwater relative to development. We are showing other Western states how creating flexibility in water law and allowing landowners to basically exercise their property rights more fully is good for the landowners and good for fish too. And it's working. And I'll tell you how I know it's working. A few years ago, so we're trying to pass very similar statutory changes in Utah and Colorado, all around the West. We have programs very similar to the one we have here in Montana. And it's been a harder slog. And so a few years ago, we came up with the bright idea of bringing some county commissioners and some ranchers up to Montana to meet with their counterparts from Utah. So, that didn't come out right. We brought folks from Utah to Montana to meet with their counterparts. And they had a series of conversations. They did some field tours. They heard the ranchers and the irrigators and the county commissioners here in Montana explain that, no, this is a good deal. Yeah, we know those freaks at Trout Unlimited are concerned about the fish, but this is good for us too. You should look into this. And you know what happened? They went back down to Utah and they passed an in-stream flow bill that allows water leasing for native trout, for the protection of native trout. It's working. What you're doing here in Montana is working, and it's setting an example around the rest of the West. So I just have a few more thoughts I want to share with you. A few years ago, I came across a little book that was written by a Jewish rabbi and an Episcopalian minister. It was called Fly Fishing, the Sacred Art. And in that book, the Reverend Mike Addis talks about the dangers of falling into a rut. And I want to share a little bit of this with you. He says, we can stay in our comfort zone, choosing flies that we know and ways of thinking that we are comfortable with. But when we have the courage to open ourselves up to newness, we are often rewarded with days when time is suspended and life is rediscovered. Days when time is suspended and life is rediscovered is probably the single best description of why I love to fish. But it is so much more than that, too. It also describes that pleasant ache in the legs and the lower back after you've spent a day planting willows, helping to shade a trout stream and create habitat for fish. It explains that catch in the throat that you get from teaching a kid about fishing and conservation or working with a wounded veteran and helping him to heal through time on the water. And it soothes the sore feet from rarely worn loafers when you're walking around on Capitol Hill or through your state legislature. Montana has seen the pendulum swing from a period of prolonged environmental degradation to one of recovery and restoration. And today we face even greater, even more existential challenges than before, with climate change and prolonged drought and more intense and frequent wildfires and fisheries closures because of low flows and high temperatures. In the face of all of that, this passion that we share for trout and salmon and for trout fishing, it can seem small. It can seem like a little bit of an idle thing, a luxury that we really can't afford. So I want to ask you to strike that out of your head, because it is not. Go back to your own Poverty Flats moment, that place in Idaho where those salmon leapt out of the river five times in succession. Go back to your own conservation creation story, if you will, and remember that first time that you connected in a visceral light in the finger, you know, finger in the light socket way with trout and salmon. St. Augustine once asked, "For what is faith unless it is to believe what you do not see?" Now, the fact is, I have no earthly idea how that lone Chinook salmon made it back 800 miles, climbing 8,000 feet in elevation to get to Poverty Flats. But I know that in so doing, she changed my life. And I do know that the more we advocate for the protection of wild places, the more we affirm our faith. And I do know that the more we keep our rivers wet and help to reconnect them, the more we gift to generations that we know and are confident will follow us. And I do know that the more we restore the health of our watersheds, the more we suspend time and rediscover life. So thank you all very much for letting me be here, and I want to make an agreement with you all right now. I will trade willingly a day of carp fishing on the Potomac for a day on the water with any of you here in Montana.